Welcome to Wagon Wheel. I'm Jared Kimber, the podcast where we answer your questions on cricket. The best way to support us on this podcast is via patreon.com/goodareaspodcast. And you can also just send YouTube super chats if you're here at the moment. I see a few of you there as well. So thank you very much. But let's get on with the show. Satchmo says, if you took Ian Chappell's Australian side in a time machine to a series in the West Indies in 1984, would it make it a close series? Relatedly, was Max Walker underrated? I think it's fair to say that that was a good side, but I don't know if the third and fourth bowling options match up. But you've got Walters, Chappell. I'm trying to think of... Yeah, I don't think it quite stands up, but it would have been a better contest than some of the teams that played them in that era. I think that's definitely fair, Satchmo. Rawl says, is Pant already better than Gilchrist? He's more used to a team than Gilchrist is because he bats in the top six. So if you bat in the top six, you allow for more flexibility. Now, Gilchrist perhaps could have batted in the top six. Australia never really needed that because Warner McGrath, the amount of overs that they could bowl, they could bowl at attacking bowls, et cetera, et cetera. Australia never needed that. I always thought Australia would have been really interesting with Gilchrist at six and Harvey at seven. Can't think if there was anyone else. Maybe Brendan Julian as well. Although not quite, maybe number seven was a bit of a stretch for his batting, but so I think there's things that they could have done in that situation, but because he didn't do that, is that Gilchrist's fault? Because I think we all know he could have batted at five or six. He also, if you look at the comparative strike rates, Gilchrist's strike rate is much more impressive than Pant's because it came in an era where people were not scoring quickly. So you've got that. You've also got someone who averaged 50. The big difference, though, at the moment is Gilchrist basically came in during his prime. Pant hasn't, well, we hope, hasn't reached his prime yet. So is he already better? No. Does he have the ability to be way better? Perhaps. But let's see how it goes. Christopher says, Test cricket in the 50s was arguably at its most boring. Correct. Why do you think this was the case? My presumption was that the war had a lot of impacts and the quality was at its lowest. I think it was a very defensive-minded test cricket. I don't think the pitches were particularly good, and I'm not sure if there's a great reason exactly why that is the case, but I think people went into test matches trying to draw more than in probably any other era ever. There was a lot of defensive bowling around the way that off-spinners bowled, the way that in-swing bowlers bowled. You could see old footage of cricket in the 60s, in the 50s, before they changed the two players behind leg side law, which meant that you had a lot of people bowling like a leg stump line, which is naturally more defensive. You talk about the war, but war doesn't, that's a very English way of looking at things, right? Because I know other countries were involved in the war, and certainly it had some impact on, it had its impact on most countries, whether they're involved in it or not. I don't know why overall test cricket would be, like, why would the West Indies be affected by that specifically, right? More than anyone else. So, I just think that there was, I think there was defensive bowlers. I think cutter bowlers were quite in vogue, and on certain surfaces, they could be very tough at that point. And bowling defensively and therefore blocking became a big thing. So what's interesting for me about the 1950s is that the runs per over is low, but also the runs per wicket is low. Like everything gets depressed. The bowlers don't dominate, the batters don't dominate, just like draws dominate. It's a fascinating period of cricket in that it's almost not fascinating, if that makes sense. Niran said, would it be fair to say that if India were bowled out for 20 in 10 overs instead of 46 and 30 overs, they would have had a far better chance at winning this game because New Zealand would have had to bat in those conditions? Also, if that's the case, how do you even begin to explain that to a casual cricket fan? Yeah, it's a very good question. Yeah, I think there is an argument for that. We don't see it as much these days. Well, we have seen it in the wet wicket era. This was something that you would see sometimes, right? Teams would be like, there's no point. We're not going to make any runs here, but they're not going to make any runs either. So let's just get them out. And then we're hoping by the end it will have settled down a little bit and we can have another go. It's a very, very risky style, but I get it. I think the issue for India was always going to be that they, I think their bowlers hit the wicket and I think their bowlers get seam movement. I don't know if their bowlers are particularly the kind of hit the wicket bowlers that you need. I know Matt Henry's release point is very similar to Bumrah and Siraj's. So it's not necessarily about height. It's more about, I think they have more a non-traditional style of hitting the pitch. Whereas Matt Henry is maybe that sort of more traditional English style of seamer. And O'Rourke obviously is about 30 centimetres taller in his release point than any Indian bowler in that game. And so is Southie, by the way. Southie's got a really high release point as well that we don't talk about that much, but I think he's right up there. So they're probably, India were always in a problem from that point of view. So even if Akash Deep had played and they had the third seamer, did they specifically have the right seamers for that weird moment? Right, they probably had the right seamers for other moments. Like, for instance, on day five, they didn't get the wickets, but I didn't have a problem. Forgetting about some of the lines and how they bowled and everything else, I didn't have a general problem with the way that they bowled. They just didn't get the wickets. I thought the conditions favoured them at that stage, whereas on day one, perhaps it favoured New Zealand a little bit. But yes, there is an argument to be said that you could have done that. How do you explain it to other people? I don't know. I don't really spent all that much time worrying about how you explain complicated things to casual fans. Actually, that's all I do. Ali says, what could have England done differently to beat Pakistan? Or were they destined to lose after losing the toss on that Multan pitch? I don't think they were destined to lose. I think that would be certainly not the way they would look at it. And it's not the way I would have looked at it if I was, you know, working with their team. You know, they got themselves into a really good position with the bat. If they had continued that for another 100-150 runs, they would have put themselves in a really good position. They, you know, again, it doesn't matter. You know, we just watched the Australia-England ODI series or whatever it was. We've just watched them in this test series. It's the same pattern over and over again with England, really, isn't it? There are moments when it looked like they're going to score at 6 runs a ball forever, and there are moments where there's a collapse. And so that is part of the style of their game that has got them a lot of success, but it also brings about positions like this. If you are whatever they were, 200 for two or 200 for one, I can't even remember now, but 200 for heaps. If you are in a position there, they should have got a lead, right? So I think it's kind of as simple as that. Also, don't think that Jack Leach bowled particularly well in that test match. If Jack Leach is bowling at his best, with Bashir bowling better than he usually does. England had the best spinner in that game and they didn't get that much out of him. Now that happens. Like, no one's expecting Jack Leach to be brilliant in every single game he plays. And we put a lot more pressure on spinners. It's like, oh, you have to be good because the wicket's spinning. It's like, well, I would like to be good, but today the ball's not coming out the way I want or whatever that may be. I think from that point of view, just making more runs would have been as simple as anything. And they would have had a good chance from there. Bloody says, if you're in charge, what would you change about how cricket is covered on TV? Would you like to see the return of commentators drawing arrows on the broadcast, or maybe you'd like match analysis segments to be changed somehow? Fielding maps is the number one thing. It's so bizarre that you're watching on TV and you have much better view of what the bowler is doing, what the batter is doing, what the pitch is doing. And the ball goes up in the air and you don't know if anyone's going to catch it. So there was a game I was watching the other day, Namibia-Nepal. So I'm on the way in to cover the India New Zealand last day. I think it was the last day. I'm watching this game and Peter Della Penna, I think, was commentating. And at one stage he goes, wow, this is weird. They've got a 6-3 field. So they had 6 on the offside, 3 on the leg side. And we're talking about like the 17th over maybe of a T20 game. And it was all to do with the ground dimensions, I think. And it's like, if the commentator doesn't mention that, we just don't know. And you are watching a Women's World Cup, the amount of times the ball would be hit in the air and I'd be like, okay, is there someone there? Is there not someone there? There was one in the final where I was like, oh, well, that's got to be out. But they didn't have a mid-wicket in at that stage. And I didn't know that because I wasn't told. I just think that's a no-brainer. It also looks good on the screen. Like, I've never truly understood why that isn't the case. I think if I was involved, I mean, we're talking about endless budgets here. I would love to have a camera, one of those hummingbird cameras zoned in on the hands of the bowlers as much as possible so that we can see exactly what is happening as the ball leaves their hand. I don't really understand why we wouldn't have that. Trying to think of some of the other things off the top of my head. I think too often in cricket, what we have done is we have said there are complicated things that former players sometimes find very hard to explain, but they know them intimately, that don't get across to cricket fans. And I think that's a huge error of cricket, to not be able to explain the sport correctly. And I personally think that is something, and I suppose that's what my channels do, right? It's what we try and do, is explain things to people. And it doesn't mean that you have to stop every single day and go, oh, hard length. Well, hard length means this. But it does mean that you are consistently, and you can do it in a way that appeals to cricket fans and to casual fans. And I think that's the big issue with TV at times. It's either all aimed at casual fans or it's all aimed at cricket fans. And there's kind of no in the middle. There is a way of doing these things that explains something so that a cricket fan can still be like, oh, okay, yep, now I completely understand it. That makes a lot more sense, etc. And there's a, but also within that, to be able to give enough information to a more casual fan to be like, I felt like I have just learned something that I needed to learn. I think that would be the main change I would have. Will says, has Stokes ever been able to play spin, or has he just gotten far worse recently? His forward defense is incredibly poor as for a pro batter. In the fourth innings of Bull Town, he just gave away playing it and swept and attacked. I think he's particularly bad at playing spin in Asia. I think the sideways spin and the balls keeping low really bother him with his technique. And the sideways spin is a problem for him if the ball is going away from his bat, so specifically with off spinners. He doesn't play spin brilliantly in the rest of the world, but I think he plays it adequately. I don't think he has any major issues with it. It's funny to me that this has become a theory recently, like in 2018. There's a reason why he doesn't average over 40 in Test cricket. And that's why I get very frustrated when people go, oh, he's a great batter. I'm like, he's not a great batter. He has the ability to play great innings. He has skill sets that other batters don't have. You know, when he locks his mind into something, he can be so robotic in the way he does it. Even when you're talking about in this fourth innings world where he's just like, I'm not going to play the forward defense anymore. His ability to just change that is not what a normal batter would do. So there's a lot of special skills that he has, but he also misses some of the most basic ones. Like he doesn't play the turning ball particularly well. He doesn't play the ball when it's keeping low particularly well. So towards the end of games, especially in Asia, he's not really going to give you that much consistently. And he's not a consistent batter as well. So yeah, I think this has been going on for a long time. But I would have to look at his overall numbers, but I don't think he's a terrible player of spin everywhere, but I don't think he's a good player of spin either. Adityan says, if you get to define the role of a head coach and that of an analyst from scratch for a franchise, what would the job's description of each roles be? How different would it be from the relationship of Lehman had with Morgan and Bayless? Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, Lehman starts with Andy Flower, doesn't he? And that he, when Morgan and Bayless sort of take over, Lehman is already a very major person. So it's a very different kind of thing than you're asking me, Aditya. The best way I think I've ever thought about it is you want someone whose job it is at the top of the cricket structure. So general manager, high performance, whatever you want to call it, head of cricket operations, whose job it is to make sure that everything is facilitated so that the team is ready at any particular time for every challenge. So if you are about to play to if you're going to play in Sri Lanka in 2 years' time, and that's going to be a key test series for you, that your backup spinners have all been to Sri Lanka or Bangladesh or UAE or wherever it may be, to spend as much time as possible getting used to those conditions and understanding what they need to do and putting themselves in that headspace. Your coach's job is really coming up with a strategy of how to make the team work. So that's why I really like what McCullum did. And I was very skeptical of McCullum just coming in and fixing everything. But what I realized about McCullum is he came in with a plan. We are this team and we're going to play this way. And I think that's what you do as a coach. You come up with a strategy of how you are going to win cricket games. And then the general manager, high performance, whatever you want to call that other position, is the person who hires you based on that strategy and then feeds you the things that you need to be able to do it. an analyst, it really depends on what kind of analyst that you're talking about, because there's the sort of more traditional analyst that you're looking at. Sorry, I was watching my son in the rain bowling in the backyard, and he's got a wicket there and just celebrated it like it's the he's taken Virat Kohli in a World Cup final. So I think that the analyst jobs are very different. So the sort of traditional, so Nathan Lehman started as the person who traveled with the team, right? That was his job. That kind of analyst is probably more to do with working with the players and with the coaching staff directly on a day-to-day basis. You then have what we're probably moving towards, and probably what Nathan Lehman becomes, is that sort of more, what would you call it, head of analytics, which is a completely different thing again. That sort of person should be working with the director of cricket and the analyst of the team in conjunction with the style that the coach wants to play. So it's a very different role there. You then have people, there are lots of, I mean, England, off the top of my head, have dozens of analysts, right? They're all doing slightly different roles. You have opposition research analysts, you have people looking at your own players, you have people with the team, you have video analysts, you have data analysts, you know, there's all these different things that all these people have available to them. But that head role, and some teams only have one person, but that head role is the one that you probably has to be working directly with the coach, the captain, but under the director of cricket. Neuron says, is it exhausting to have to watch low-quality cricket because it's part of your job? For example, during the IPL, when some games are just so soulless and would be forgotten in a week. All leagues have this problem, but they don't get as much coverage. I like watching cricket. I am the sort of person, if I'm going for a walk and there's a cricket game in a park, I'll probably stop and watch a couple of balls. That's pretty consistent. Right across the board. I've got the betting apps now, which allow you to watch pretty much a cricket game almost 24 hours a day. It's very rare that there's not a cricket game on, plus YouTube and streaming and all those sorts of things. It's very rare that I would do exercise without cricket on. If there was, when we had 99.94, I was trying to set up a global cricket radio station so that there was always live cricket being broadcast on an app that you could have in your pocket. I probably would have had that on all the time as well. So I don't know. I don't really see it the same way that you see it. You're watching a soulless game, and I don't really know what that means, but if you're watching a soulless game, there are still subplots and there are still small battles and there are still moments and boundaries and the ball has got wet and everything else. So maybe I just see it very differently than other people do. All right, let's have a quick break here on a Wagon Wheel and we'll be back in just a few moments. As a cricket journalist, I would travel up to 200 days a year and I loved every part of it except for one, this little evil pin here, because I needed this to change my SIM card. And when you travel in cricket, you're quite often going from country to country. Don't get me started on how much this would annoy me in the West Indies, but even going from New Zealand to Australia, this pin was the worst. Well, with the Sally eSIM, they sort all of that out for you. They have an eSIM app that you install once, it's cheap, and it works in more than 160 countries around the world. No more turning up at an airport and lining up for a local SIM, trying to give over your passport and your details, and you just want to get in a taxi and go where you're going. No, Sally make it so much easier. You just download the app before you travel and you decide what kind of plan you actually need. Oh, and if you do that with our code, GOODAREAS, all one word, you get an exclusive 15% discount on Sally eSIM data plans. So go right now and download the Sally app and use the code GOODAREAS, all one word, at checkout and travel like a pro with Sally. All right, welcome back. And Neuron says, Ben says, appreciate this might be difficult to answer given your working relationship with him. You may also have more insight as we see. Why is Bumble not on Sky anymore? Oh, okay. I think if you look at what Sky did, there was a huge movement away from, who are the people that have all left Sky in the last, I want to say 5 years, but it might even be slightly longer than that. Both them, Gower, Holding, and Bumble. I think they all have a common denominator. And I don't want to put words in Sky's mouth. I'm sure they had individual reasons. And I think with Mikey, they probably would have liked to hold him, pardon the pun, hold him around for a little bit longer. But I think they were trying to move on and get a new generation. I think they probably thought that Rob Key was going to be the new Bumble. And it should be pointed out, I don't have a particularly good relationship with Sky. I don't know if I've ever been on Sky. I probably had, despite being an English, a writer in England in test matches over and over again, I probably get mentioned more times on a South African broadcast that I'm not even covering than I ever have on Sky. When we made a documentary about the future of Test cricket, I wasn't on Sky, right? Like, it doesn't really seem to matter what I've done. I haven't got there, and I don't know if I've upset someone or if it's just one of those random things. They've got plenty of other people that they can get. They seem to be a little bit distant from what I would call the written press. So it's not just me. I think there's a few other people there. So I don't have a great relationship. So this is not like inside knowledge, but I look at it and I go, there's a bunch of older guys. I think with Rob Key, Rob Key was, I thought, on his way to being perhaps the next Bumble. And perhaps they just thought, well, that's fine. And they could move on and go in that direction. But it seems to have gone a lot younger, and that's also fair enough. I'm assuming their audience has. I'm sure Bumble's told me, but I can't even remember exactly. In fact, I don't know if I've ever even talked to him about it, if I'm being honest. Maybe I have. But yeah, I do think there was an idea of like, they're looking for younger people to come through, and, you know, everyone's different. Richie went way too long, probably. There are probably some other commentators. They've probably commentated on a bit way too long. So maybe Sky wanted to stop that or slow it down. But yeah. Shriram says, Safraz Khan played the short balls pretty well in the second innings against New Zealand in the first test. How do you think he'll fare in Australian conditions if he gets a chance? I think it was good because there was good carry and pace. It's not an Australian wicket, though. The ball doesn't come on in the same way. It doesn't have the same kind of verticality and that consistent extra bounce. But I think it was if I was his agent or his coach, I'd be like, that's a good sign. You know, that's a good sign about how you may be able to translate your game over. It's not a one-for-one comparison, but all you're looking for is a bunch of little signs that make it easier for them to potentially pick him into the future. And I think it's fair to say that was one that we saw. Will says, given England batting on roads, but hate of a spin, should Australia try to prepare wickets a turn more than usual for the Ashes? And if they wanted to, could they even do that with most of their grounds? Look, Australia has such a natural advantage in their wickets that, like, it's Australians are the most anti pitch tampering sort of sides. And it's like, of course we are. We come from a place where no other country can replicate what we do. So there is such a natural advantage in Australia that the idea of having to tamper their wicket, the only time we should have tampered their wickets was to try and take the bounce out of them for the West Indies, and they certainly didn't manage that. We have seen England win a test in India of recent times when the pitch was spinning enough for Tom Hartley to get wickets. So I don't know, and there was another couple of tests when they were in those games against India. So I don't know if I'm ready to throw them out based on the last game. And they didn't play particularly well in the last game, and I don't think anyone's going to have any arguments there. But no, there's no way Australia would do that. Whether they could do it these days, probably with drop-in wickets, they could if they really wanted to. I just don't see them thinking that way at all, ever. Cam says, what is your favourite commentary duo? I used to love Kerry and Harsha together on ABC Radio. Ooh, I never really thought about this. It's a really good question, Cameron, and I might not have a brilliant answer. I used to love Tim Lane and Peter Robock. It just felt like people had hired really intelligent people to speak about the game, which, you know, wasn't always the most normal thing in the world. That was one that goes back a long time in my mind. I'm trying to think if there's anyone else that I... there was a period, and I don't think they do as much anymore, but there was a period where I really liked Bishop and Duhl because, again, they were searching for answers and they were covering the modern game so much that with their mind open. I know Dooley has his issues with analysts and computers sometimes, which I think he probably needs to get over and is probably misunderstanding things a little bit as well. I'm more than happy to chat to him and I'm sure he'll tell me I'm wrong, but I definitely think there's an issue that with that. But I think Dooley's searcher for information and Bish is sort of maybe a more natural person when it comes to that as well. So I thought of those as a very good partnership at times. I can't think of any others. I'm sure there are heaps of others, but I can't think of any others off the top of my head. Ian says, I know that in the past you've said the standard of Australian women's team has been a good thing for the women's cricket and helped drive standards up everywhere. I agree. So is the World Cup when none of Australia, England, India made the final and only one made the semi-finals a vindication of that process? Perhaps. Look, Australia becoming... There's actually not a lot of difference between the Australian men's team and the Australian women's team in that England is now, you know, especially their men, but also their women, are so professional. And they're so professional because Australia dragged the game into professionalism in, you know, late 90s, early 2000s. If Australia doesn't do that, we probably don't have a situation at the moment where we have so many talented players from around the world. We don't have a situation probably where there is... where a Scottish player can go on their phone and get a bunch of clips of an opposition team they're going to go up against, or where a Nepalese player has the ability to work with a physio to, you know, build their core strength or whatever they need to do. Like, Australian cricket moved professionalism so much that it changed everything else. And it's done exactly the same thing in the women's game. So I don't know if that makes it a vindication, but when West Indies were great, because it was kind of externally done to them, I don't think it really changed the way people thought about the game outside of it changed the way we bowled. Very specifically, it changed the way that we bowled. If you look at West Indies, the T20 side, I think there were some more changes there where it started to play a part and people had a look at it. And I think if you see with women, it's probably a little bit of England making their side professional, and then on the back of that, Australia making the entire structure professional, has meant that everyone now understands what you're playing against, right? You're not going up against another team, you're going up against an entire system. And so you have to do everything within your power to get to that point. And so that is probably what we have seen in this World Cup. It is very possible that Australia win two of the next three World Cups, and India or England win the other one. And this is just a blip as well. But I do, watching this tournament, catching aside, but throwing, running between wickets, I think women have always been pretty good at strategy, the way they think about the game. Or certainly there have been outliers where some teams probably haven't been. But I think overall, like, it's just clear that you're watching a much more professional game. And a lot of that has to be, you know, keeping up with the Joneses, right? Like, trying to beat Australia. Shriram says, Siraj averages close to 61 in the fourth innings of a test match, which is almost twice his career average. There are only 12 innings. He is bowled in the fourth inning. So I understand the sample size is a little bit small, but averaging 60 is ridiculous. I don't exactly know what the reason is, but in the majority of fourth innings, the pitch would have already wear down and there would be very little seam movement. So is Siraj completely ineffective? I kind of feel that Siraj is someone who kisses the pitch a little bit. And so when the pitch is maintaining pace or maintaining movement, that sort of the ability to kiss the pitch at that stage is a huge advantage because... there's a little, it is a little bit quicker. The ball comes on a little bit more. It's a little bit sharp. Everything he does is a little bit sharper. I think as the innings goes on, his inability to whack the ball into the surface probably causes him to miss out on cracks, inconsistent bounce, maybe as much as some other bowlers might. You know, the variables of, if you compare him to someone like O'Rourke, which, very different kinds of bowlers. But someone like O'Rourke, if the pitch is doing anything on days 4 and 5, O'Rourke or Mornay Morkel or those kinds of bowlers should be a handful because they're hitting the surface very, very hard. Whereas if you're not and you're kissing the ball off the surface, you're probably more reliant on the pitch being a little bit quicker, a little bit of grass coverage, the seam doing some of the work for you and everything else. Whereas day four is probably less so of that. I think when you're looking at things like that, the only other thing I would say is, as you said, there is a very small sample size. So on something like that, I would very rarely be in a situation where I would only look at test cricket. So I would instantly go into his first class record where he has played quite a lot more. Let's see if I can bring that up. And I would almost, let's leave the test stuff in for the moment. Let's have a look here. Fourth innings. Why can't I find his innings breakdown? There we go. So first team innings in first class cricket in general, he averages 24 and second one 28. So there's a bit of a pattern there. Fourth team innings, he has bowled in the fourth innings 22 times and he averages 42. That probably suggests to me that it is largely a test problem, if your numbers are correct, and that in first-class cricket, we haven't seen that as much. But I do think you see a little bit of leakage from his record, although he's still got a pretty good record in the third innings. But yes, I don't think the fourth innings, and not all seamers are good in the fourth innings for obvious reasons. He's probably someone who needs freshness in the wicket. I think for me, with Siraj, his absolute best is probably in a day-night game when there's just a little bit of moisture around and the ball's skidding on. I almost think that's when he's almost unplayable. That's very different conditions than a day four, day five first class game or test match, right? Very different. Let's have another quick break here on the Wagon Wheel and we'll be back soon with more of these kinds of shenanigans. All right, Josh says, thoughts on Ravindra, Phillips, O'Rourke, Sears, Jameson, if his back ever recovers, as the core of this team in 5 years' time. Ravindra, I think, is a fantastic player. So I have no real issues there with him. I suppose it just depends on what happens in his life from if he gets to the point where he ends up with $2 and $3 million IPL contracts, how that affects him. Glenn Phillips, I've been long on the side of Glenn Phillips. He hasn't yet developed into the kind of player that he should be. So I'm still hoping he does. O'Rourke and Sears, based on, I've seen a bit of Sears, but I've seen a lot more of O'Rourke, I think, at the moment. I'm just not sure that you want them both bowling in the same game together. I'm not sure they're ideally partnered. I mean, Jameson's obviously a freak. Jameson and O'Rourke together, or Jameson and Sears, I think is a good partnership. But I'm not sure if you want two of those bowlers in there. There's something there, but I think there's a lot of players aging out, Josh. So I think if you're being realistic, you're kind of cherry picking a couple of players, but Conway, Young, Mitchell, Blundell, Henry, Southey, Hejaz, that's a lot of players to replace. And some of them will stick around and some won't. Ben says, if this current England team could pick from a 20-year-old Joe Root or a 20-year-old Kevin Peterson, who do you think England would choose from? For the sake of this argument, 33-year-old Root and his clone can play in the same side to the disgust of scorers everywhere. The Roots, good band, The Roots. So your 20-year-old coming through of both. Well, probably a 20-year-old, you would pick Joe Root, right? I think if they were coming through now, because it took KP a few more years to become that level of player. Let's say it's 22-year-old or 24-year-old, because I think that's the argument you're really asking about. The issue that I have there is that Joe Root and KP were very much from the era that they played in. So a 20-year-old Joe Root now or a 20-year-old Kevin Peterson now would still come through this system. And so Joe Root would be more and more, if he can play scoops over his head and everything else, you might pick him. They might go with Kevin Peterson first, but I don't think that means they wouldn't pick Joe Root in that situation. Rudra says, with Sajid Khan and Noman Ali spinning Pakistan to victory, and Pakistan have found a template that they can build on could Pakistan have found a template to build on at home in Test? I know with the use pitch, there were special circumstances. I don't know how often Pakistan is going to go into a Test match with the best spinners. It's very easy to say that these guys did well, and I thought Sajid Khan bowled really well, and I thought Noman Amal, he took 11 wickets. I don't think he impressed me as much as Sajid Khan, but there was certainly something about his bowling. They still didn't have the best spinner in the Test match, right? And so how many teams would they have a better spinner than at the moment? New Zealand? Not Bangladesh? Not Sri Lanka? Certainly not India. That's not going to be an issue for them. Certainly not Australia. Probably not South Africa. I'm not sure that Moti isn't better than these two, but maybe I rate Moti too high. Do you know what I mean? There's a lot of other teams with better spinners. This was a bit of a freak event. If they do it again on a flatter, well, not flatter, because it wasn't a flat wicket, the last one, but on a more normal wicket, like as in one prepared for cricket, not just hanging around for an extra week, then I'd be much more interested, Rudra. I would be. But after that, I'd need a lot more. Titian said, I liked your answer last week about equal contractual play between men and women. In passing, you mentioned about the effect of professionalism in women's tennis. What are a few things that we can learn from tennis? I think the big thing with tennis is I still believe that one of the reasons that tennis was the biggest women's sport in the world is because it was run all women, right? It wasn't run by the men. It was run by the women, which means they marketed it the way they wanted to. They sold it the way they wanted to. I think it had a natural advantage in that women play tennis at a higher percentage than many other sports. So it's easier to have women's tennis run by women or women's netball run by women because of the numbers in those sports, right? It's very hard to do that in cricket, where such a small percentage of the women were playing cricket up until, 1990s. So it was always harder to do that. But if you look at the history of women's cricket, when it was run for itself, it wasn't an add-on. It was the main event. Here is the women's game. We are running it. It exists for us to play and watch. And I think when the men started running it, it becomes an add-on. So I've got some issues there. The roundabout with that is, of course, that the group that ran women's cricket were incredibly amateur. Like, essentially just like a small committee, like at your local club. Like, it was so small, even around the world. And they didn't really understand how to market things correctly. They didn't get the money that they always needed. Like, it just wasn't, it wasn't run that way. So it is both things. But I think now, and I think everyone who's followed my channel will probably know what I'm about to say next, but I think women's cricket should run itself now. I think it's at a point where it should just go off, get its own deals, sell itself in its own way, and not be an add-on to the male game. And I think that it's now in a position where it can do that. And also, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but women's cricket can be annoying to the cricket boards from a perspective of they don't know what to do with it. The majority of cricket boards are run by men. The vast majority of the cricket boards are run by men. Men's cricket runs itself. They don't have to do any work, right? The classic Usman Samiuddin question at the Big Three takeover press conference was, what makes Cricket Australia, ECB and BCCI the best boards in the world other than the fact that they have the biggest markets? Nothing is the answer. In fact, they weren't the best boards in the world. Many, many times over, they have not been the best boards in the world. So you get yourself into a situation where it's very easy to run something that's really, really successful and is selling itself. It is much harder to do that to the women's game on its way up. Now it's getting slightly easier. But maybe what the women needs is it to go out on its own. And maybe there is still a share situation that we can come from. And I don't really understand how to go with that. But yes, I think it'd be interesting to see. I think everything should be split up. I don't think the ICC, which don't really run anything anyway, should be deciding test laws, playing conditions, should be hosting a World Test Championship, should be hosting a T20 tournament, should be having women's under 19. Like, I just think there's too many different things there. How does global cricket, global women's cricket grow when the main group is looking after the men to begin with, when they have to look after multi-formats, they have to worry about silly things like bat sizes and zombie no balls and DRS protocols. And all. It just feels to me that there's like a group of people who love women's cricket who now believe that it can be funded, which it can be, to go off and do it on its own. I think it would be its own unique sport. And I think in some ways that's what tennis is. It doesn't mean you don't still come together for the major opens and everything else. But I think there is something to be learned from all that. All right. We'll have another very, very quick break, and then we'll come back with comments from the room here on the Wagon Wheel.
Occasionally, I also talk about behind-the-scenes stuff. Huge thanks to everyone who has supported us on Patreon and helped us build this channel. Join our Patreon community and unlock exclusive benefits. Enjoy AMAs, live calls with me, and connect with fellow cricket enthusiasts on Discord. Express your cricket fandom with Bodyline t-shirts. Discover their extensive range of player-inspired tees, featuring cricket legends such as Murali, Warne, and Wasim. With team-themed designs and options for hardcore cricket nerds, they've got you covered no matter what your interest in cricket is.
All right, welcome back. Let's have a look at some of these comments. I think we've got a couple of super chats in here as well. Dorob says, I have this feeling that India will go back to spinning tracks to win. If yes, I mean, they're going to Pune, mate. I don't think there's much of an argument that they weren't going to go to spinning tracks. And also, how many tracks do we see in India that are like seams specialist tracks anyway? This wasn't supposed to be. There was just a lot of water. If yes, then do you think it will be the right idea, considering it will be a panic move? It won't be a panic move. It will just be the wicket that they're playing on. I don't think I want my seamers in the next two tests to be completely worn out anyway, if I'm going to Australia, where I'm going to have to use my seamers a lot more. So if I was working with the Indian team, I would say, let's have spinning tracks. That doesn't mean that they have to be ragging sideways either. Just has to mean that there's assistance for spinners, which, to be fair, they didn't get masses of them out in the last game. But wicket spin naturally in India. Like, it's a bit of an odd question in some ways, because it'd be like Australia playing a test match in Sydney and it didn't get quite as much bounce or as pace off the wicket. And the next match is at the Wacker, and you saying, I think Australia should go back to faster wickets. It's like, well, most of their wickets are faster, and the next one sort of answers the question anyway. Igant says, does being religious benefit players more than being atheistic? How do team systems best allow players to practice what they believe? Well, I've been asked some bizarre questions. I have no idea. You're asking the wrong person. You're asking an atheist if religion has any basis in anything, and I would, as a heretic, probably say not. And it's a horrendous system that is built to control people's lives by a selected few who pass it down and pretend that they have got magical messages from various things. As I said, I'm the wrong person to ask for this, right? Like, I fundamentally don't believe in religion. I think in professional sport, if you want the sport answer, there's two sides to this. One is that players need to have a unnatural belief in their own gifts. There are certainly players who I know who are atheists who just have that naturally. I can do this, and so I will continue to do this, and no one will stop me. And there are other people who probably believe that they were blessed by some sort of god or deity with this special talent. And so, what's the Drew Bundini line? How are you going to beat God, son? About Muhammad Ali, right? So I think it probably plays on both sides. If you ask me, the people who ask questions the most, the people who seek true truth and science and best practices are probably the people with slightly more open minds. But there are also things within religious beliefs and systems that probably allow you to be, I'm trying to think of the right word, but because there are so many religions that have so many different practices, if you think about this from a sports perspective of like, you know, I'm doing this thing, even though I can't see the results straight away. That's kind of what religion is at a certain point, no? I think as well. Like, isn't there a little bit of that? There's like the big argument in sport that you kind of need to be either so smart that you can unpack a entire situation and repack it all in your head. So that sort of Ashwin Donny, Joker, LeBron style athlete who can just almost see the matrix codes, right? And then the other side is a player who is very, very sort of limited, right? And just like see ball, hit ball, and is only good at a couple of things, and is not interested in learning anything else. That's sort of, I don't know, Dennis Rodman, or like, you know, a football defender whose only job is to make sure that no one else is ever going to score goals. They're not interested in getting the ball down the field or anything else. Literally, their job is to make sure that the striker will never get in front of them or past them or into space or whatever that may be. But yeah, there is no answer to that. You can't. Realistically, it's, I think the best way to put it out would be that there's a huge amount of athletes who have autism and ADHD and probably other things on those kinds of, I don't know what you call them, mental health spectrums. And there are a lot of those cricketers who use that stuff to make them better cricketers. So Benny Howell has talked about how ADHD has made him a better cricketer. Whereas you talk to Mitchell Johnson, and I think he would admit that it caused him issues as a cricketer, right? So the idea that being religious or being an atheist, there could be a player who's massively religious and that's the problem, right? Let's say there could be another player who is a massive atheist and that's the problem. And also vice versa in both of those cases. You kind of use what you have in life to get better. And in some cases, you might have situations where your religion or your atheism or your lack of belief or whatever that may be gets in your way. Soem says, in the last scoreboard, you talked about your approach to your work as a storyteller. What are your favorite non-cricket fiction books? Probably fiction books. This one probably, I don't even know if you can still get it. It's probably been cancelled quite a lot. But I absolutely love, oh my God, I've forgotten the name of it. The Dice Man. Or Dice, is it called Dice Man or That Dice Man? I should know that, shouldn't I? But the Luke Reinhardt book. I read a lot of, I've read a lot of Chuck Palahniuk's books. Albert Camus is probably someone that I've read quite a lot of as well. Harlan Ellison in science fiction is someone that I've read a lot of. Trying to think of some of the other books. Not as much anymore, but certainly in my late teens, early 20s, like a lot of poetry was probably something that I was really interested in. Again, someone else has probably been cancelled, and probably quite rightly in his case. Allen Ginsberg was someone I read a lot of his poetry throughout that kind of that period in my life. Charles Bukowski was probably another one. I don't read as much fiction anymore. I probably, around the age of 23, 24, really moved from books to cinema. And I'd always watch a lot of cinema, but I completely went to cinema at that stage. And so I'm probably more likely now to read screenplays than anything else. But, you know, it just, there's something, I absolutely love novels. But, you know, cinema probably took over my life at that point. A Potato says, would Laura Wolfart end up the best batter of this era? I think she's already better than Mandana, but can she topple Mooney and Siva? Lennings Peak started in a different era, so counting her out. The issue with Wolfart is what her strike rate is going to be. So I think Siva Brunt, the strike rate differential between the two is, and I'm just guessing off the top of my head, but my memory of it is quite substantial. Laura Wolfart should always make more runs than Siva Brunt. She's up the order. She's more consistent and everything else. But women's cricket is so, it's all white ball, right? So I don't think you could say that someone is the best player if you don't factor in their strike rate. So I think you would have to do that. So, I got rid of the question there. I haven't gone through it. And also, as you're saying, I'd have to work out who's in whose era and all that sort of stuff. I think, though, if I'm not mistaken, no, I didn't actually. I don't think I have Laura Wolfart in my top 10 women's batters of all time for my book. But I think I said probably by the time the book comes out, she might be in it. And I'm trying to think if Siva Brunt is in it. But I know I wrote about both of them in the book. I mentioned both of them in the book. So I can't remember if Siva Brunt's up there as well. But yeah, very different kinds of players, so hard to compare. Moon is really good, but, Laura Wolfart might play for like an extra 10 years beyond Mooney. So at that stage, unless Mooney is 15% better, then the argument starts to swing back to Wolfart anyway. AB says, when and why was it decided that pitching outside off for an LBW is fine, but pitching outside leg is not out? What happens if pitching anywhere is fine for LBW? It basically ruins the game, AB, because it's the same thing we were talking about with the 1950s earlier. It basically means that you start bowling defensively. If you've ever played in a game, and I've played in like trial games where we've tried regulations like this, everyone just starts bowling down the leg side because you can set a very effective feel for it. And also you kind of, when you're hitting to the leg side, think of sweeps and pull shots and hook shots and all the flicks on the leg side. You can't really see the fielders until you hit the ball. So think about this. Like when you're hitting to the offside, you're facing the offside a little bit. And so you have a chance to be able to pick the gap. Yeah, you might still slice the ball or, hit it a little bit earlier, whatever else. When you watch people play on the leg side and specifically from mid-wicket back, you can't see them at all. And what happened in the 1950s when we were still allowing fielders to be more than two fielders behind fine leg, you had this even worse situation, of course, where you had defensive bowling and defensive batting happening at the same time. Absolutely would utterly ruin the game if you change the LBW law to allow this to happen for two reasons. One, everything I've just said. The second one is when you are lining up as a, let's say, a right-hand batter, the outside leg stump is slightly out behind your eye line. So we would have to start batting more front on, which would take away from the aesthetics. It wouldn't make cricket prettier. It wouldn't make cricket more entertaining. It wouldn't make cricket more fun. I can't see it on the green here for some reason. Mensahit says, if allowed to experience live one of these unrecorded events, which one would you choose? Capital Dev's 175 or Wilt's 100-point game? Fantastic question. I suppose as a cricket journalist, I would pick Capital's game because then I would have an advantage over everyone else. And I would literally be writing down notes ball by ball and then coming back to the future and just being like, I think you'll find in the seventh over, this happened. So that would have been fun. Wilt's 100-point game, we don't know. I mean, I would say he did score 100 points in a game, but we don't know 100% if it did happen. So being able to be there and fact check it or not. But I would have thought, I've been to basketball games where people have scored massive totals before. I didn't find that as entertaining as when I've seen like 175 from a collapse. So if you're asking me from that, like I would probably prefer to go to a game, I don't know, where Wilt scored 50 points with 15 assists and 40 rebounds or something. You're like with bunches of assists as well, where he was the hub of it rather than just a 100-point game. So I'll go Capel there. Soham says, in your latest pod with Bumble, you had a discussion on Stokes versus Cummins. What about Stokes versus Jadeja for a random test without knowing the venue? The only reason you pick Stokes over Jadeja is that the seam bowler is of more use in test cricket altogether. Or if you need more of a counter-attacking batter. I mean, Jadeja's become a really good test player, but very much within his square, within his box. Probably from that point of view, fielding, I suppose Stokes is worth more in a test match for his fielding than Jadeja is because catches are worth more than outfield. And to be fair, Stokes is pretty good in the outfield as well, if you were to go into that situation. If you go back, Soham, we did a video on the main channel where I had Jadeja as the, if you're doing a draft pick and you weren't worrying about ages tomorrow, you're drafting every test player, I think he's the number one pick that you would choose because of the flexibility that he allows your team. Fully fit Stokes is about the same. I suppose I might go Stokes when he could bowl up towards 90 miles an hour. Maybe this version of Stokes, you would go for Jadeja. And even though they probably average very similar over a large period of time now, I think Stokes' innings have more impact in the way that he plays. But yeah, I don't think there's much in it. I mean, I'm trying to think more of peak, of who you would go at their peak. Jade's pretty good at his peak as well. I think because Stokes can bowl in Asia and he can bowl not in Asia and still be a high impact bowler. I think he averages about 35, 36 in India, for instance. And I don't know what his overall record in Asia is, but you know, the ability to reverse swing it, to bowl bounces and everything else. That's the thing with seamers. They give you more flexibility if they have that sort of skill set. So, you know, if you've just got a seamer who's just a new ball bowler. So there's Nathan Smith, who's coming up in New Zealand, who's a really interesting prospect. But Nathan Smith, when he gets to test level, might not be able to bowl with a new ball. So even though he is a really good bowler and he can bat a little bit, does he actually add to your team with those skills? And we've seen that with some of the South African all-rounders they tried after Callis, right? Where it's like, yeah, I get it, but this guy needs the new ball, or this guy can bowl, but he can only bowl this one thing. So that's why, in general, we always had this big argument. You won't find many bigger fans of Vernon Philander than me. But the argument always was that you would pick Ryan Harris over Vernon Philander, forget fitness and everything else, because Ryan Harris can do multiple things. So Ryan Harris can bowl seam up and he's a brilliant new ball bowler, right? You then can give him a spell later on where he just bowls really, really fast. He was a properly fast bowler when he wanted to be Ryan Harris. And then you have a third option for him as, you know, he actually didn't win a test match, but he got straight back into a test match by just bowling bounces. So you now have three different options with him. Whereas Vernon Philander, you have one option, right? You can use that option throughout the game because he doesn't get smacked, whatever, but it's the first part of the innings, right? And it's the same with Jadeja. Jadeja is a brilliant bowler, but spinners don't give you the same amount of flexibility as a seam bowler can. The other argument here, which I think is really interesting, is Jadeja can bowl you more balls per game. So you might not just get as much flexibility, but because a spinner can bowl, I don't know, what would Jadeja bowl? 50 overs a game, maybe? That's probably not quite that high, is it? Because India's games are lower, but let's say he bowls 35 to 40 overs a game. Well, Cummins, who are we talking about here? Stokes is probably going to bowl you 20 to 25. So I've almost talked myself back out of it. I don't know which direction I would go. I honestly find all-rounders very, very confusing when it comes to all the different ways we look at them. We'll eventually do a video on the main channel where I try and wrap my brain around it. You know, we're hoping, obviously, that our next book on batters does very well, and there'll be a book on bowlers if that is the case. But trying to work out what is a good all-rounder and what is not a good all-rounder and how we should look at that, I think is such a fascinating one, right? Like, if Callis averages 32 and Sobers averages, what, 34, 35, but Sobers is bowling almost twice as many overs. Like, is that better? Callis bats at 4, Sobers bats at 5 and 6. Is that better? And you know, I would be in a near constant circle with this, but it's a fantastic question. Cyril says, "How does it feel to be so good at what you do?" Thank you, Cyril. Look, I don't know how much we've talked about my story on this channel, but we'll go into it a little bit. I'll tell you some story that I've never told anyone else. But I was kicked out of school twice when I was, I'll say, 16 and then 17. I think I was asked to leave the first time, then they brought me back. And then the second time, I think it was more of a mutual thing, but I think they were very much getting rid of me. I then went and did gardening school at 18, I want to say. The information wouldn't stay in my head of what I needed to learn. And so that was absolutely useless to everyone. So I left that. I did a lot of call center jobs, a lot of factory jobs. I probably had about 30, 35 jobs, car parking, all these sorts of, you know, weird menial jobs. And then when I was about 25, 26, I went to film school. Again, didn't finish film school. I would argue that that was the film school's fault, but they would certainly argue that it was my fault. I then somehow stumble into the whole cricket / online space through filmmaking and kind of by accident through, you know, writing a blog and everything. I'm very conscious that I'm extremely different to almost every other cricket writer, cricket media person in the world. I was back then, and I still am. Even when I'm in a generation now where, like, there are copycats of my copycats, right? I feel like a bit of an outsider. So when you say, how does it feel to be so good at what you do? I'm still in a situation where I'm still the kid who didn't finish high school, right, mentally. There are some times, though, with a piece of work where I'm just like, I don't think anyone else could do that, right? That's not to say it's the best work in the world, but I don't think anyone other than Jared Kimber could have put this together the way that Jared Kimber has put this together. And I know I've thrown everything at it. You know, so, you know, the, I suppose the next big project is, well, actually we've got a small YouTube documentary series that we will probably put up in the short term, but there's a couple other big projects outside of the Good Areas Network. Like I'm doing this documentary for Channel 9 and I've written this book for Bloomsbury. And it's like at the end of that, I just feel it feels really good to do the job correctly. But I think a lot of the reason that I'm driven to do all this work is because I still don't feel like I'm quite there and I don't feel like I quite fit in and do things correctly. And very recently I found out, almost accidentally, that I have dyslexia. Obviously, I don't have the dyslexia that makes me jumble up words that much, although if you listen to some of the recordings of my scripts, my producers and editors might disagree. But I found out I had dyslexia, and I think, so there's a I'm in this constant battle that there isn't, it's very rare that you get to stop and just think you've done it or made it, because I have to pay a mortgage and I have to get more work and our sponsors dropped out and I was expecting to get this job and I didn't get this job, or, you know, and I was told, you know, a couple of years ago, ESPN were like, we want you to be our global writer and go around and write all this stuff for ESPN.com. And I did like 2 or 3 hours of conversations and everything. And then they just changed their mind, right? Like that was the job that I had probably wanted since I was a kid and suddenly it disappeared. So I never feel that comfortable. And I remember this story between two Aussie rules footballers. One was Nathan Buckley, who played for my team, Collingwood. And the other one was a guy called James Heard, who played for Essendon. And James Heard was basically saying to Nathan Buckley, isn't it great when you're out on the field and you realize that it just comes easy to you? You just, like, you can almost sit back and watch it, right? And Nathan Buckley turned to him and went, no, I've never had that. I felt like I'm constantly on the grind trying to, you know, win every moment. And if I don't, it's all going to fall apart. And that story always struck me of two of the most talented athletes I'd ever seen, the completely different way they went about it. And as I get older, I realize I'm a Buckley, right? If I'm not on the grind for my next gig, I literally finished the Channel 9 documentary series, sent off all the scripts, and the next thing I did was pitch a bunch of ideas to another organization, right? The next thing so I don't think I sit back, Cyril, and ever do that. And I think it's just not what drives me. It's not the background I have or anything. I just feel like I've been so lucky and that it could all go away at any stage. And so I just keep working. And, you know, that's why we're doing this now. Ikan says, which cricket ground has the best location in terms to its connectivity, surroundings, infrastructure? I love anything in a city. For me, anything in a city, Ikan. So I would say Adelaide Oval instantly comes to mind. MCG is probably maybe slightly further out. Oval is another one that feels like it's in the center. Lords. I'm trying to think of some of the ones in the rest of the world that I know I've been to and I can't think of any. But I love the idea of just being able to stay in an area. Like even SCG is not quite in the middle of like Sydney. It's like, you know, right next to Paddington and all that area. So you've got all these cafes and bars and then you can just walk down to the ground. I love a walk. Massively big fan of a walk to a cricket ground. I'm trying to think of some of the other stadiums around the world that just feel like they're part of a community, right? I think those are the ones that I love the most. I think it does feel like the Australians have kind of nailed the idea of having a sporting stadium as the sort of central hub. I'm trying to think of any in, I suppose Wankhede's not far from the town, is it? So if you like the posh part of Mumbai. But that's another one that I feel like is, you know, you've got the Marine Drive on the other side, but I don't think you can come out of Wankhede and instantly go to cafes, restaurants. That's kind of what you want. You want that full thing. So at Adelaide Oval, you can go back into the center of Adelaide or you can go to the other side of Adelaide North Adelaide, and there's, I think it's O'Connell Street. It just feels like in any direction you leave Adelaide Oval, there's a place to go and talk about the game with your friends. And it's a nice walk to get to the ground. That for me is kind of the ideal situation when it comes to those sorts of things. Samit says, KG with 302 wickets at 65 tests. I won't go through the full numbers. Doesn't this make him better than Marshall, Steyn, and Wacker? Also a petition to start the Fab 3 with KG, Boomer, and Cummins. That's not a bad idea, actually. We probably should have, right? If they were batters, we would have done that. No, he's not better than Marshall. Marshall averages one run less per wicket. I think at the moment he's had a better career than Wacker, but you have to factor in what other seam bowlers were doing in the same games. My guess is the fact that Steyn and Rabada both have two of the lowest strike rates of all time, and they've both played in modern South African wickets. You can't overlook that, Samit. If I'm doing this the same way that the thing that we looked at the most in our book was like, how do all these Australian guys have these massive batting averages? But that's such a common thing. How much of it is home versus away and everything else? And don't get me wrong, Rabada's record away is really good as well. I think Marshall is a better bowler than him. I think Steyn is a better bowler than him. I think he's more similar to Wacker in that Rabada and Wacker are just absolutely brilliant machines in one particular way of taking wickets consistently over and over again. Whereas I think Steyn and Marshall had just more options available to them. So again, if you're looking for flexibility, the difference is that I think that Rabada might have Wacker just because of he's managed to stay fit for longer. Like he's managed to be at his peak for a lot longer. Soham says, Cyril said, I just talked about my life and journey. There's a book I've written, which is on Kindle, which I'm hoping most of you can access, and it's fairly cheap. It's called The Lily of Camberfield, so spelt Dennis Lilly and Camberfield, C-A-M-P-B-L. I've just looked up my name in Amazon and you can find it. It actually has quite a bit about my early story. It's really a story about myself and my father. He's the Lily of Camberfield. And so there is an element of that in there. I don't know if I even want to write a traditional memoir or anything like that, but there is some more personal stuff that I have done that we just haven't had a chance to make videos and stuff out of that I would love to get to. I love doing cricket, but I love telling other stories as well. So, you know, the ability to be able to tell multiple stories, and I have had a bit of a freaky, weird life. I'm absolutely no doubt when it comes to that. So I would like to do more there. Mensahedge says, have you written a film script you'd revisit? Very, very interestingly, I wrote a film script in, 2005, 2006, which essentially kind of foretells the MRA movement. And I've also written a book that sort of did the same thing. And now those things have happened. And I think if I'd released them at the time, they probably wouldn't have got a lot of attention, but maybe further down, people would have gone, oh my God, it's all here. And sort of also the online community. So I'm trying to think if there's a particular script. There's one novel that I wrote, which I didn't quite finish. In fact, it's probably more notes than a thing, which could easily be made into a movie, which is all about cricket. It's kind of about the birth of the franchise system. But that it's not really about that. But, you know, that's where it's set, right? That sort of ICL, IPL period. I'm trying to think if there's any other scripts that I wrote. I think everything else. Oh no, there is one other script that I've written, which is probably could be reused again as well. And, but it's, you know, I've got two novels. Yeah. I've got two novels fully written, which I haven't had enough time to just work on and get them in a position, to be able to do that. It's where I'm hoping one of my, you know, if I can get one of my cricket books up to a certain level, and now that I have a relationship with Bloomsbury, I can kind of go back to Bloomsbury and say, okay, now we're selling copies. I also want to be able to do this. You know, who can you put me in touch with and everything else? It goes back to Cyril's original question, which is, you know, I haven't ever been in a situation where I can just sit back and not do anything. I've never had that level of success. So, you know, I've got friends who've written a book and then been in a situation where they've sold so many copies of that book that they don't really need to do a lot in the next year. And so they can kind of plan ahead. Everything for me has always been very hand to mouth. You know, Death of a Gentleman, I lost money making Death of a Gentleman. So even though it helped my career, it didn't actually help my finances in a way that, you know, I could go and do something like that. I didn't get paid a lot by Crick Info. So even, you know, I couldn't really ever save up money from Crick Info to spend the next 2 years afterwards, you know, working on those sorts of projects, film scripts and novels and everything else. But yeah, I have two novels. I think in the last couple of years, I've been asked to write two scripts for people, which haven't gone anywhere. So I never even got to the point of writing the script, but one was based on the Archie story, which is the Afghanistani player who ends up in Kansas. And the other one was, the other one was when Ted Lasso came out, like every prominent sports writer in the world probably got a call going, you should make the Ted Lasso on your sport. And I was one of them. And I had a screenplay of a cricket sitcom, which I still really want to work on one day. Cause I think it's a really cool sitcom and no one's done this idea still. So I really want to get to it, but yeah, it's, fairly unlikely that I'll ever get back to it, at the moment. But you never know. It's really just about time, and it's really great. It's one of the reasons that we really push hard and we're trying to land a couple of major sponsors on this channel. It's not that I want to get rich. I really want to be able to be in a situation where I have so many talented people working for me at the moment and so many other people who want to work for me at the moment, which we can set up a system where so much of the content now is, you know, it doesn't have to be driven by me. I can oversee it and add to it when it needs to be and train up everyone else so that I can then work on these bigger projects. So the last, I can't remember now, but September and October, the majority of September and October, I was working on, you know, 3 hour long documentary scripts. And that is because of the group that we have here. So your super chats go towards that, me being able to fund all those sorts of things. Noah, I can't see your chat. Noah, oh, wait, here it is. Says, with all the suffrage you've seen today, do you think he has the game for center? His technique will, look, I don't think his technique will work in center, but I didn't think that Steve Smith's technique would work in England. We've never seen it before, so we're going to need to see someone like him do it, but he has the talent and hand-eye coordination to carry that off. Last one, Safra's KL Grill, in center for all conditions. I think if it was me at the moment, I would pick Safra's and Gill and know that KL Roll is there if I need him. There's no problems with that. That's what KL Roll should be. He's the utility player. Use it. Gambier has talked about them wanting to take risks and all this sort of stuff. Well, Safra's is the risk, but he has a higher ceiling than KL Roll does at the moment, right? So if that's the risk, go for it. If it doesn't work, whacking back for another one. Oh, just on Wright Thompson, I said, bring Wright Thompson again for another episode. I will. I don't think he's done anything in cricket. I know he still watches. And very occasionally he'll send me an email asking me a question on something, but I will bring Wright back on. But he's released a new book about the Emmett Till case. I think I'm right in saying it's the Emmett Till case. You know, he's a great, great friend and you know, just a great person and obviously one of the best writers, certainly in sport and outside of sport, if we're being honest as well. So I'm sure we'll get him back on. Anyway, I've got more podcasts to do, so I better end this one and I'll see you again very, very shortly here. Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bahram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. We'll be right back. If you make any content, Minbo Pro is the tool for you. Take your long format content and cut it and slice it for social media. This AI-inspired weapon will turn your one piece of work into so many clips. Try Minbo.pro now.